The Acts of the Apostles, chapter 17. We are following Paul in his second missionary journey, which begins at the end of the 15th chapter in Acts, and goes right through into chapter 16, 17, and up towards the end of chapter 18. And we have been following Paul in Philippi, and then from Philippi we saw him moving westward towards Thessalonica, where he preached for three Sabbaths in the synagogues, opening and alleging that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead, and that this Jesus whom I preach unto you is Christ. We're told that some of them believed and consorted with Paul and Silas, and some of the Greeks, devout Greeks, God-fearers, Gentiles who had grown weary and sickened by heathen religion, had come in contact with the Hebrew scriptures translated from the Hebrew into Greek, and they were beginning to worship and to seek to know more indeed of the God of Israel, and they listened with great interest to Paul's exposition of the scriptures, which they had grown somewhat familiar with. Many of the Jews, were told, who did not believe, they were moved with envy, raised an uproar against Paul, and indeed the apostle was in jeopardy of his life. His friends took him away from the city and escorted him to Berea, which we were looking at last time, verses 10 to 15. And we saw that Paul's ministry was very much the same. The fact that he was threatened with the kind of ministry and the kind of message that he was proclaiming from place to place, he did not change his method. He simply carried on doing the same thing with the same inevitable results. Some were convinced, some were not convinced. But we are told concerning those believers in Berea that they were more noble. The word noble here is a word that has to do with eugenics. It's a word that means well-born. And it may not be that they were all gentlemanly born of the blue blood, so to speak, but they were spiritually more upright and amenable to the gospel than some of those at Thessalonica. And they searched the scriptures, as we saw last Wednesday evening. We could have spent another Wednesday. Indeed, I was tempted to do so, but I decided not to to deal with this topic of searching the scriptures. I remember many years ago now preaching on that text, and I thought that would be worthy of repetition, but we leave it. It is a good thing for us to search the scriptures, because in the scriptures we are made wise unto salvation. And the only message of grace and the gospel that we find in the whole universe is that which is written down for us in these holy writings of the Old and New Testaments. So there is a lesson there for us in Paul's ministry and the way that these Bereans received Paul's ministry. But inevitably there was resistance, and as we indicated last time, the more of a response, a positive response to the gospel, the more you find that there is an opposite, a reaction to that. And very often down through the history of the church, it's been a corresponding reaction. A great response to the gospel is inevitably accompanied by a great resistance to the gospel. Where there is little response for, there is little response against. Nothing seems to trouble the powers of darkness more than a response, an enthusiastic, public, a zealous response to the gospel, where men and women call upon the name of the Lord and search the scriptures, seeking to know more of this wonderful message of grace in the gospel. And so there was the opposition again at Berea, and once again Paul was conducted from Berea to Athens. And from verse 16 to the end of the chapter, we have an outline of Paul's ministry at Athens. Now, it's important for us to keep in mind that Luke is simply taking events. This isn't a history book strictly. It is a history book, the Acts of the Apostles, but it's more a kind of a witness document. It's not a document that sets out to give a blow-by-blow account of everything that took place. It is simply recording how it was that the prophetic utterance of Christ, way back in chapter 1 at verse 8, "You will be witnesses to me, beginning in Jerusalem, and then in Judea, and then Samaria, and then to the ends of the earth." And the Acts of the Apostles is nothing more than a brief outline record of how that prophecy or that program of evangelism actually was accomplished in the apostolic age, and how it was that the gospel did in fact go to the Gentile world. And so Luke here is not concerned to give us every detail. And here in this chapter, we have Paul being, as it were, led away from Berea, and then we find him at Athens. But that's quite a long journey, actually. And if you look at a map, you will find that this is a summary of the city where Paul left and where he went. There's not a word about his journey. It would have been a long journey. There were two ways that Paul could have gone from Berea to Athens. He could have gone by land and gone down from Berea up in the north through that mountainous country down through the eastern coastal region of Greece, and finally ended up in Attica and, of course, in Athens, which was the capital city of Achaia at that time, the Roman province of Achaia. Or, more likely, he would have traveled by sea and done quite a long sea voyage down the eastern coast of Greece, past the great long island of Euboea, right down to the south, up north again, and landing probably at the port of Piraeus, and walking the 10 miles or so to the city of Athens. So it's quite a lengthy journey, but we are given no account, because that is not the important thing. What is important is what Paul said and what Paul did at Athens. And so Luke just gives us a brief record. And bear in mind that Luke is writing after the events have taken place. Luke's gospel is written his Acts of the Apostles and the gospel too. These accounts are written years after these events, because this gospel or this Acts of the Apostles closes with Paul imprisoned at Rome. And Paul's imprisonment at Rome is somewhat 10 years or so in the future from the time that Paul is ministering in Athens. So Luke is simply looking back and selecting certain events that are high points and pinnacle points, anchor points, you might say, whereby we can understand something of the development of Christianity among the Gentile world. And what is being emphasized is the preaching of the gospel and the inevitability of response to the gospel. Because wherever the gospel is preached, people will respond. You tonight will respond to what I am saying. It may be a positive response, in which you are receiving more truth and growing in grace. Or it may be a resistance and a resentment, in which you will not make any progress, and you'll become harder in heart through familiarity with the old story, but getting nothing out of it. And so there is inevitably going to be a reaction in the light of what the preaching of the gospel presents. So what does this preaching of the gospel present to us in this narrative of Paul at Athens? Now, it's quite an interesting narrative, and it's straightforward, and it's quite lengthy in a sense. And we're going to spend a week or two looking at Paul's ministry in Athens, simply because Luke takes more time to go into the details concerning Paul's ministry in this place than he goes into in describing Paul's ministry either at Thessalonica or at Berea. We don't know how long Paul was at Athens, but it's obvious that he was a fairly lengthy duration. Not years, not the way that he was at Corinth, for example, where he was at least 18 months, as we're going to see in chapter 18. But obviously, before Paul preached his great sermon at Athens, we're told how he was witnessing in the marketplaces. And he was speaking daily with anybody that wanted to come and listen to him. And that's what they did at Athens. Any public speaker in Athens could stand up and give his particular message, and people would gather. It was that kind of city. It was that kind of society. And so obviously in these verses 16 to 21 that we have at the beginning of this ministry of Paul, this is occupying some considerable period of time because he was meeting daily in the marketplace. So this wasn't a day's ministry being recorded. This is several weeks at least, possibly even months, that is being recorded here. But Paul is more concerned to go into the details concerning the sermon that Paul gave on Mars Hill when he was invited by the Areopagites to come and address them. These were the philosophers. These were the men whose opinions and doctrines were shaping the life of Athens. And so Paul was given an official invitation to come and be the speaker on this particular occasion. And they would gather and they would listen to what this man had to say, because he was obviously saying something that was very strange to their ears. He was preaching about Jesus and the resurrection, Jesu and Anastasis. And they thought that these were two different gods. They had never heard of these gods. They had other gods, but they never heard of these gods. You're bringing strange gods to us. Well, tell us more, is the requirement of these philosophers who want to know what these gods are all about, that this strange little man is preaching in their midst. And so they give an invitation to Paul to come and to speak on a big occasion, and Paul does so, and he gives his great Areopagus address, which we shall look at, God willing, in due time. So we're going to look at Paul's ministry in Athens. And this narrative, it divides up really quite neatly into these three sections. It's amazing how many messages in the Bible just fall into three parts. Sometimes three-point sermons, you don't have to go looking for a three-point division. It just falls out that way. And that's the way it is. And this narrative falls neatly into three sections. Verses 16 to 21, we have an account of the events that took place before Paul's great Areopagus address. And then from verse 22 to verse 31, we have the actual content of Paul's sermon on that great occasion. And then from verse 33 to 34, we have the inevitable response to Paul's message on the Areopagus on Mars Hill in his ministry in Athens. So we're going to look, first of all, this evening, at Paul at Athens generally. And notice what we're told about his stay in Athens. Now, while Paul waited for them, that is, Paul is waiting for his companions, for Silas and Timothy to come and join him. While Paul was waiting for them at Athens, we're told his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. And therefore, because of this stirring up of his spirit, he was disputing in the synagogues with the Jews and with the devout persons, that's the God-fearers, and in the market daily with them that met with him. And that included, of course, in the marketplace, those philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics. But what is interesting is that while Paul was waiting for his companions to join him from Berea, He was obviously seeing the city. He was wandering around the city. And Paul was, as it were, stirred up by what he was seeing. Now, what was Paul seeing in Athens? Paul was seeing the ruins that you and I can go to Athens to see today. He would see the Parthenon. He would see other temples. And there were many temples in Athens. Paul was looking at the glory that was Greece, the glory that was Athens. The great days of Athens had passed 500 years before Paul went there. And yet many of their great buildings and their forums and so on, and the places of fame, the prison where Socrates had been imprisoned, that was still there. It's still there to this very day. You can go and visit it, according to archaeology. And the places where these philosophers met, it's still there. It's a cleared ground. Apparently part of the Athenian metro rail system passes through it at this present time. But nonetheless, you can go and walk on the grounds where these philosophers used to meet and where they would hold their debate. You can go to the place where Plato established his academy and so on. And all of that, Paul would see all that. And Paul, no doubt, would be impressed. Paul was not a Philistine. There's a famous comment made by a critic of Paul, a man by the name of Renan, who says that on this occasion when Paul went to Athens, this Philistine little Jew, this ugly little Jew, he describes him. He says that he has got no eye for beauty when he could pass by all these wonderful statues and only, as it were, criticize the Athenians for the statuary and for the temples that they had built. But Paul is not at Athens as a tourist. He is not a man who is blind to the beauties of art. Paul could appreciate good art, good sculpture. And the art and the sculpture, particularly the sculpture of Greece, it has been unequaled, not even the Renaissance, of which we are so acquainted, Michelangelo and all these great sculptors. They were simply imitating what the Greeks had done all these centuries before. Nobody has ever equaled the statuary or the pottery, the beauty of that which was produced by the Greeks way back in the great classical times, in the 5th century BC. And all that was over by the time Paul arrived in Athens. And no doubt he had an eye for it all, but he was seeing something else. Because Paul is not at Athens as a tourist, simply to observe the beauties. He is there as a Christian. And furthermore, he's there as an apostle. He's there as a preacher. He is there as a man who has a new life in Christ in him. And he sees the beauty, but behind the beauty he sees the decadence. He sees the despair. He sees the disillusionment. He sees the false religion. He sees all the depravity that was inherent in the very beauty of these statues and these temples that you find in Athens, even to this very day. What is the great Parthenon, after all, sitting up in the Acropolis there? It is a house for the patron goddess of Athens, Athena. And she was one of the best known and most loved and worshipped of all the goddesses that the Athenians invented for themselves. And they made a great statue, 40 feet tall, we're told. It no longer is in existence. And the ruin of the Parthenon is something really to behold. But behind it all, there is the ignorance of God. Not only the ignorance of God, the rejection of God, according to Paul. There is what we are seeing here, what Paul is seeing, and what you and I must see behind so much religious statuary, including many cathedrals in Christendom, and all the great buildings that the church has chose to erect for itself in order to be impressive and to impress the world. Behind it all, there is a spiritual decadence. The Christian church has got no right to try to build, as it were, those great temples with steeples reaching up to heaven. The church doesn't need that. The church's mission and the church's masonry really in the world is in fact a spiritual mission and a moral stature. That is what is going to impress God and going to impress the world. And so Paul has an eye for beauty, all right. But he sees that that beauty is a deceptive thing. Underneath it all, he says, you Athenians are too religious, as he tells them here in verse number 22, when he begins his great sermon. And I've mentioned to you before, this is a rather big word, you are too religious. It's a word that means superstitious in the sense of believing the wrong things. Because right in the very heart, as I've mentioned to you before, in the very heart of this word is the word demon worship. All idolatry, all false religion, according to the Bible, is demonic. The Apostle Paul reminds the Corinthians, you may remember, that those offerings that the heathen give to their false gods, they are actually given to demonic powers. Any religion that is not a biblical religion, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, all the isms, they are demonic according to the teaching of the scriptures. That is according to the teaching of the biblical, the Jewish scriptures, the Christian scriptures. Now each of these religions, they've got their own scriptures. They have the Quran, the Buddhist scriptures. The Hindus have their scriptures, their Dhammapada, and so on and so forth. And their Vedas. All these religions, they all have their writings. But we also have writings in the Old and in the New Testaments. And in our writings, we find that all these other writings are dismissed as inaccurate and deadly and dangerous. They don't lead to God. They actually lead away from God. And what Paul was seeing in all the religious imagery in Athens was not a religious imagery that was designed to bring men into the knowledge of the living and true God. It is actually an imagery that the more you devote to it and the more you give yourself to the gods that they represent, you're actually moving further and further away from the living and the true God. In other words, images of all this kind, they are not aids to religion. They are not aids to worship. They are actually hindrances rather than helps. God is a spirit and God will be worshipped in spirit and in truth. Nothing else. There's no other way to worship God other than in spirit and in truth according to the teaching of Jesus. And so Paul here, his spirit, we're told, is aroused when he saw all the idols and the altars to every god under heaven, and including all one, he says, and actually there were more than one. Paul mentions here one to an unknown God. But there was more than one altar in Athens to an unknown God, an unnamed God. Just in case we've missed one out, here's another altar that we shall erect. And Paul here is aroused. His spirit was provoked. His spirit was stirred. This is a very strong word. This word here, stirred. It's the word from where we get our English word paroxysm. And when you're in a paroxysm, this is not just some slight ruffling. This is something that is deep. It can mean anger, it can mean grief, it can mean indignation, it can mean a variety of things. But it means that we are feeling very, very deeply either for something or against something. And we're told here that when Paul saw the idolatry of Athens, he was stirred up in opposition to what he was seeing. You see, the Apostle Paul wasn't simply going to treat all these idolatrous images and what have you as little insignificant things. They represented the deadly decadence and the sheer depravity of the religion of Athens. What kind of religion was it that was in Athens and had been for centuries, indeed even in its greatest age, the great Periclean Athens in the middle of the 5th century BC. What kind of religion was it? It was a religion that said that women could not have a voice in a court of law. It was a religion that said that slaves were things rather than people. One third at least, maybe more than one third at least, of the population of Athens in its greatest heyday were slaves who had no rights. And when we think of the great Athenian democracy, that was limited to a very, very limited, narrow constituency. About 30,000 or so at the very most, according to Socrates. And Aristotle is the man who in his great book on ethics, he says that slaves are not to be considered as human beings. They are things to be exploited, and once they have passed their use-by date, they can well be put to death, and there's no murder charges involved. And there was bestiality. And there was homosexuality. It was never officially sanctioned. It was frowned upon, but widely practiced. And even Plato and Socrates approved of that particular practice. The use of young boys. And so on. We don't want to multiply examples. Athens was a cesspit, as every human society is a cesspit, where Christ is not known and where false religion dominates even the best endeavors and the best efforts. And where you have a nation like Australia, which sanctions same-sex marriage, you have signs of the same kind of depravity, the same kind of indecency, sanctioned by the society that you found at Athens. And Paul, as he contemplated these things, he wasn't just saying, well, that's their opinion, ho-hum, let's get on with life. He was indignant. He was in a paroxysm of rage and indignation because he cared for people. And he saw the insult to God that was being perpetrated on a daily basis in this so-called great city of Athens. That's what Paul thought of Athens. He saw it as a place in desperate need of the gospel. And so when Paul was, as it were, waiting for his companions to join him, he wasn't, as it were, sitting twiddling his thumbs. He was going around and he was discussing the things of God in the synagogues, once again back in the synagogues with the Jews and with the God-fearers, those devout persons. And in the market daily with anybody that would meet him, Paul would be a wandering evangelist in the many outdoor markets in Athens. And then there were those certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics. They were the highest and the best that Athens could produce, indeed that Greek culture could produce. And yet when you read their philosophy, I've been reading lately the writings of Seneca, writing to his young friend. He was a Roman, but he was a Stoic. And there is no hope, there is not a scratch of hope in the philosophies and the religion of the Stoics. You had to put up with life. Life was hard. You simply had to bear it. And then you died. And who knows what happened once you die. And the Epicureans, they were the ones who said that the greatest thing out of life is make the most of it while you can. Life is brief, death is sure, and then that's the end of things. So enjoy life, and that included pleasure. The greatest virtue was to indulge in pleasure. The fullest life was the pleasurable life. Good food, good relationships, good everything. Pandering to the flesh. These were the highest that Greeks could offer. No real concern to worship in humility and in repentance for sin. You can indulge yourself in indecency and in sodomy and still be an Epicurean. They were all, not all, but they disapproved, but they would still do it. That's the kind of muckhouse that Athens was. Very similar to the muckhouse that Sydney is today. Very similar. And let's be clear about it. It's possible for us, as citizens of a city, to become so used, so immunized, so, as it were, anesthetized against what is going on in the culture to which we belong, that we simply don't see it anymore. And so we pass the pubs and the clubs and the brothels. We pass the parliamentary building who pass legislation, which is a slap in the face to the gospel, to Christians and to God, where they are saying publicly in their legislation, we have no interest in your God. We are going to do the same kinds of things that the Stoics and the Epicureans and the people of Athens and the people of all these ancient cultures. We are going to go back to the life of enjoying life, and we're going to indulge it. And don't come to us with this gospel message about repentance and the need to walk in a way that is pleasing to a holy God whose eyes are so pure that he cannot behold any iniquity. This is the circumstance in which we find the Apostle Paul waiting for his companions to join him in Athens. And we're told of what these Athenian philosophers thought of the Apostle. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics, they encountered him, no doubt in the public place. That was where they met. Paul was going to the places where he knew that people gathered, in the markets, and where these wise men would discuss some new philosophy, some new sophistry, to enlarge their knowledge of what the good life was, that thing that Socrates was speaking about all through his life. What is the good life? And they didn't know what the good life was. And some said, what will this babbler say? This word babbler here is an interesting word. It means a seed picker. It's a word that means here is someone who wanders, like the Stoics, like the Sophists used to do. They would go around picking up bits of wisdom here and there. And they would read books and they would listen to lecturers lecturing, and then they would put it all together and make up their own lectures based upon these tidbits that they had received from other men's studies. I suppose like many preachers who go into those books where you can actually buy books of sermons. And I know of some clergy who use books of sermons. And instead of studying the scriptures, they open a book and they'd say, well, that will do me for this weekend. And those philosophers were doing that. And they at first thought that Paul the Apostle was simply one coming with doctrines that they had never come across before. But he had picked it up somewhere in his travels. He's a seed picker, like a bird going around picking up the seeds. That's what the word actually means. And they were interested in this seed-picking speaker because he was preaching about things that they had never heard about. What will this babbler say? Others said, he seems to be a setter forth of strange gods, I've already indicated to you, because he preached unto them Jesus and Anastasis, the resurrection. Now here we have the content of the apostles' preaching. The same message that he preached at Thessalonica, it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and then to rise again from the dead. The same message that he preached at Berea, Paul is not changing his message in Athens. Everywhere he goes, he is preaching about Jesus Christ, crucified for our sins and resurrected from the dead on the third day. Obviously, these Athenians did not understand the significance of Jesus and the resurrection. And Paul has to explain to them in his great Areopagus address. Because he does refer to it again. Wherefore he has given assurance unto all men in that he has raised him from the dead. At the end of verse 31. And it was when they heard the explanation of the resurrection from the dead that some mocked and some believed. Some got the message and some got the message, but they didn't want to get the message. And so they mocked and ridiculed the very idea of the resurrection. And so this is the background to Paul's great Areopagus address. He is waiting, he is indignant, he is disputing with the Jews, he is speaking to the people in the marketplaces with the devout God-fearers, with the philosophers of the age. He is speaking things that they don't understand, they've never heard. He is longing to give an explanation, and the opportunities as they came, Paul will seize the opportunities and point out the foolishness and the deadly danger of idolatry and present them with an alternative. What is the alternative to the gods and the goddesses of Athens? The alternative, the only alternative that the Christian faith offers is Jesus and the resurrection. What is the only cure for the ills of our ignorance and our infirmities and our iniquities? It is Jesus and the resurrection. What is the only cure for your problems in life, your real problems? It's Jesus and the resurrection. It's not churchianity. It's not denominationalism. It's not baptism. It's not attending the Lord's Supper. It's knowing Jesus and the power of his resurrection. And the apostle, when he is indignant and brought to a paroxysm of his spirit, that is an evidence that he has experienced a new life. In the same way as our Lord Jesus Christ, when he went into the temple in Jerusalem, you remember, on two occasions, we believe, at the beginning of his ministry and at the end of his ministry, he saw that the house of the Lord, the house of prayer for all the nations, had become a den of iniquity. The church had become a money-making racket. And prayer was largely ignored and misunderstood and misapplied. And the things of God were given second place to the things of mammon. And that's the kind of situation that our Lord Jesus Christ was angry at and was indignant, and he was going to do something about it. When he made the whip of cords and drove them out. What a scene that must have been. What a racket that must have been. Turning over the money changers. How dare he do such a thing? And all the animals bleating and the scattering of the animals and the scattering of the coins. And the birds fluttering and squeaking. You can imagine the absolute mayhem that he would cause. And he did it twice. So aroused was he and indignant about the false religion that was masquerading in the very house of God. It's the same kind of thing here that Paul is facing in Athens. And it came to the point where these philosophers and these Areopagite personnel, they were saying, we want to hear about this. May we know what this new doctrine is whereof you're speaking, for you're bringing strange things to our ears. We want to know, therefore, what these things mean. And there is a very sad comment here in verse 21. It's in parenthesis in our version. And we are so familiar with it, but yet it is a very sad comment. For all the Athenians and strangers which were there spent their time in nothing new but either to tell or to hear some, in nothing else but either to hear or to tell some new thing. Because no matter what they hear, they're still discontented. It doesn't bring peace to the soul. And it doesn't bring the sense of forgiveness to their most needy inner man, because they don't know God. And no matter what they're going to hear from their philosophers and their wandering sophist lecturers, nothing is going to satisfy. Always they're wanting to hear some new thing. And it's like that among many professing Christians. They're not content with the old gospel. They want to hear some new thing. And the more new it is, the more they like it. Can't you be original? No, we can't be original. Because gospel preachers have no business to be original. It's not our task to be original. Like the apostle, we tell you the same thing over and over and over again. In the same way that Jesus did. in the same way that the prophets of the Old Testament did. They had no new message, the same old story for new circumstances, but always the message, hear the word of the Lord. And there would be those who would say, we're sick and tired of hearing the word of the Lord. Tell us something different. But then there are those who say, yes, please tell us more of the word of the Lord. And so when Paul is invited to preach, he takes the opportunity and up he goes to Mars Hill. There's a plaque there to this day. Whether it's the right place or not, I wouldn't care to comment. There's a discussion whether it's the right place or not. But there is a plaque on Mars Hill, not far from the Parthenon, actually. And it is supposed to be the place where Paul stood. It apparently was the place. It's a natural kind of a pulpit. And apparently that was reputed to be the place where the philosophers would stand and give their philosophies. And so Paul was invited to stand up and to speak. And he stood up. And from verse 22, we're told of his sermon. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, ye men of Athens, I see that you are in all things far too religious in a demonic way. Now let me tell you about this God whom you are trying to worship. I see that you are trying to worship God, but you're worshiping in ignorance. Now let me tell you about this God. And from verse 23 onwards, Paul tells them about God. We're going to have to spend some time looking at Paul's sermon. We don't have time this evening, but that's the beginning of Paul's ministry in Athens. He is a man who is white hot. He knows what he's talking about. He obviously is respected in a measure by the philosophers who invited him. They wouldn't invite any Tom, Dick, and Harry. You had to be very interesting, and they had to be concerned to hear what you've got to say, because they were hearing news. A great deal of what they were hearing was absolute nonsense, and they could hear it in a moment. But here is a man who seems to be speaking something that has a ring of truth about it. Now you come and tell us more about this, and we'll listen, and you talk and tell us about Jesus and the resurrection. And Paul begins to preach. God willing, that will be the topic of next Wednesday's meeting.